Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Cliff. If you listen to Earth Ancients each week, you hear about the ancient places we talk about. We are down in Central America, South America, we're in Asia, we're in Europe, we're all over the world. A great opportunity to discover the ancient past is to join me this fall for a trip to Maya land. I'm going to be taking a small group of people, October 28th through November 4th, through Yucatan Peninsula, Mexico. This is 7 days of climbing pyramids, walking among some of the most amazing ruins in the world. Some of these ruins, I think, are actually part of a much older culture, perhaps Atlantis. We're going to go to museums. We're going to travel in an air-conditioned bus. We're going at a time of year where it's gorgeous. And our home base is going to be in Mérida. Come out and join me. It's a great opportunity to see these places, and I've made it very, very convenient. It's usually about $3,000. You'll read about most of these tours for $3,000 to $4,000. My tour, hanging out with me, 7 days, everything's covered, is $1,600. That sounds like a little bit of money, but it's not, because it's 7 intense days every single day. We're climbing pyramids. We're walking on ancient trails. We're looking at museums. We're checking out artifacts. We're climbing buildings. We're going to Chichen Itza, Uxmal. These are the oldest and the best known Mayan cities in Yucatan. Some of these areas we're going to, we'll have shaman with us to walk with us to talk about where we're going. To get the entire itinerary, go to earthancients.com. Go to the tours. Click it. You'll see what we're doing every single day. Come out and join me. This is a great opportunity. We're half filled with the tour. We've got a few places left. I'd love for you to join me. Check it out. Earthancients.com, a trip to see the ancient Maya. Okay, so here's today's show. July 1st, 2017, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Hey, if you were part of that program, if you were listening to the Atlantis program, Atlantis on Earth with William Donato, I wrote an article that just appeared on in Ancient Origins magazine. And if you're not big on Facebook, if you're not into the social media sign, go check that article out. You can go to ancientorigins.net, and I've actually posted all the photographs that appeared on the Facebook page. These are the side sonar images that William Donato took in 89, and then again, color side sonar images that were taken in 2007. And they're pretty startling photographs. Some people think they're fake. They're not. They're actually authenticated by a number of scientists. They were taken by technicians, and they are supported. And that last trip was funded by ARE, which is Edgar Cayce's foundation. So check it out. You can go to ancientorigins.net. It's called Atlantis Unearthed. That's just the title of the article. And it's also on the Facebook page. So if you want to go to Facebook, it's there too. I just posted it on Facebook. But for those of you, again, who don't like Facebook, hey, there you go. You got it. Also, I was talking to my webmaster. I am going to be linking articles from the Facebook page onto the website. So you'll have a regular list of fresh articles. You can go there on a regular basis. A lot of people just are not into social media. And hey, that's fine. So this is going to be an opportunity to read my posts, my articles, a lot of the material that I post on the Facebook page, and also the hundreds of contributors that post galleries, articles, post information about our ancient past. So stay tuned for that. When I launch it, I'll let you know. I'll give you a heads up. It's probably going to be in the next 10 days that we do this. So earthancients.com. Hey, and go to Earth Ancients anyhow. If you're not registered, get on the page. Go to earthancients.com, scroll to the bottom, register so that you get regular updates on articles, on information, trips that we're doing, books, tapes, and other things that are being produced as we continue forward. Gaia is our sponsor, and we'll have information for Gaia. Gaia has a lot of packages and tapes and things like that that we'll be discounting in the near future. So check it out, earthancients.com. Okay, so what's going on with the Peruvian mummy? There's a lot that we're going to be talking about today. There are a couple of stories that we'll talk about. Today's program is about American giants. That's the theme. But this this mummy story has gone viral. Literally every news agency has a story about it. And a lot of it is positive, but also a lot of it is negative, thinking that this is a hoax. We'll have the entire story. We'll have Ashley Cowie coming in to us from Colombia later in the program. And as I had told you before, we have the producer of the Gaia short videos on this. And Melissa Tittle, who's the producer of a lot of the programming around this mummy, will be talking to us about her impressions. Hey, and this is really a curious mummy. If you haven't heard about it, they found a mummy in some caves that are in the Nazca, Peru region. These is one of many mummies, is what I've just found out. These are unusual mummies simply because they have elongated skulls. The one that they're featuring has very big eyes and massive orbits with eyes. And what's curious, really curious about these mummies, or this singular mummy, and apparently there's other mummies with the same kind of physicality, is they have elongated hands with very long fingers and very long feet. Three fingers on each hand, three toes. Very, very strange humanoids. And some people are saying, is this evidence of an alien? Well, nobody knows yet. They've dated the remains of this mummy, this actual physical mummy, to 1,000 years or older. We're going to hear more about it, so stay tuned for that. You know, I'm keeping an open mind about it simply because I don't know, and a lot of people simply write it off. They write it off as soon as they hear about anything that is unusual. I think that's too limiting. There's a lot of rumors that this mummy has been manipulated in some way, that the hands have been manipulated, and there's evidence of sewing marks and things like that. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of science behind this, and this is what we're going to hear about today. So I find it quite unusual. There's evidence and there's a lot of documentation in the videos that have come out of beings that had three fingers. There's pottery, there's other artifacts. There's even some pictographs that have been recorded of beings that walked around that had three toes, three fingers on each hand. So hard to say. We just don't know. Hey, Earth Ancients is sponsored by Gaia. And Gaia is now 8,000 programs and growing. There's a series I just checked out. It's called Forbidden Science. And if you haven't been to Gaia, I really encourage you to check it out. The programming is around Tesla's science, anti-gravity science of engines that need no gas, that can run on water, can run on hydrogen. If you're into science, if you're into alternative science, check out Gaia. To check these out, it's Gaia, GAIA.com/Earth Ancients. And their special program, they're keeping it for us. It's 99 cents for the first month. And after that, it's about $9. Hey, you can't go wrong. Check it out. 99 cents for over 8,000 tiles. We're talking about pyramid culture. There's a ton on pyramid, ancient civilizations. If you're into the UFO aliens, if you're kind of following the ancient aliens, check out what's going on with the UFO alien interactions. There's a tremendous amount of material on wellness, alternative healing, Danning, mind, body, spirit, and mindfulness techniques. This is all designed for you, and there's a ton of material here. Like I said before, I thought it was like 7,000 titles. There's 8,000 titles. So check it out, gaia.com/Earth Ancients, 99 cents to start, and after that, it's about $9. So I hope you'll join that.
The boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
And each week we post a series of news articles and information that not only I, but a number of other people collect from around the world. Hey, and this week, if you go to the Facebook page, go to Facebook, go to Earth Ancients, go to groups, we have a whole bunch of really cool stuff that's been coming. I mean, every week, I actually have to go through and edit. I have to edit a lot of stuff because there's just so much that comes in, and some of it's kind of strange, doesn't really fit our format. But this week, there's some really cool new technology that's being introduced. It's imaging technology, and it's pretty cool. They found the skull of a man that lived 500 years ago in Dublin in the UK. And what they have done is they can now scan a skull from, you know, that has, you know, all the typical structures. They hasn't been crushed. It hasn't been cut, damaged in any manner. If they can find and submit a perfect skull, they run it through this scanner, and what the scan does is actually add the musculature and the skin and approximates what the person looks like. And these scans are so effective that they have reproduced this gentleman who lived 500 years ago. I think he died around, he was like 25 to 30 years old, but it is literally amazing. It is detail across the board, the eyes, the mouth, the nose. You got to check it out. It's a beautiful reproduction. It's a new technology, and science is using it now to approximate what people look like in the distant past. And 500 years isn't that long ago, but it's long enough to raise our curiosity. So check that out on the Facebook page. John Bonneau has been submitting galleries now for the last couple of years, actually John Bonet, and he has submitted a Megaliths of Spain gallery that is fascinating. He's got over 40 images of massive stoneworks from Spain, and these are buildings. These are megaliths of multi-ton size rocks that somehow have been put together, created standing stones. There's buildings, there's platforms, there's sacrificial stoneware. John, thanks for submitting that. It's always amazing to see what you dig up. I mean, John is constantly looking for anomalous features around the world, stoneworks. And this megalithic site in Spain, this actual gallery in Spain, is quite eye-opening. So check that out on the Facebook page. It's kind of fun. And thanks for your contributions, John. That's a great series of photographs. Keep it up. Keep sending that stuff. We have an article from Ancient Origins magazine on ancient hydro engineering in Peru. These are the waterworks. And, you know, we take a lot of these stone waterworks for granted, but apparently a tremendous amount of work is done underground in canals and water repositories, water collection systems that we just don't know about. And this article gets into the detail of how they keep the water running. And these Waterworks are extremely old. In fact, they don't really know how old they are. They could be 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 or older, years or older. And this article goes into how water was collected thousands of years ago. So ancient Peruvian hydro engineering, you can check it out on the Facebook page. We also have an article on a discovery that was made about 2 weeks ago. The world's oldest jewelry was found in Siberia, in a Siberian cave. They were collecting some bones in there, and they found a 30,000-year-old piece of jewelry that was very, very well constructed. And I've posted it. All the scans, all the details are on the Facebook page. There's a number of scans to show how it looked. It's pretty fascinating what they can do. They can reconstruct from just a piece of this. It's a piece of jewelry that was found under a couple of feet of dirt. So check that out. All right. So here we go. We're going to start talking about the mummy. So our first interview today is from our regular contributor, our correspondent in Colombia, Ashley Cowie. And this is what Ashley has found, the latest evidence from a Colombian and scientific perspective. So Ashley Cowie, here he is. So each week we want to check in with our South American contact, our South American eyes, ears, and thoughts. That's Ashley Cowie, the host of the People's History Channel. He's a historian, author. And each week, it's a check-in time. So, Ash, how you doing?
I'm really well, Cliff. How are you?
I'm good. So, what do you got to say regarding the mummy? I hear that there's local South American publications, newspapers, periodicals that are reporting about it. We want to kind of get a sense of what the South American public is, how they're responding to this phenomenon. So, what's going on?
Right. The last time we spoke, you must have been, I was pretty convinced that this was either a 3D laser printed creation in the last year, but I'm kind of coming away from that, to be really honest with you. I've done a lot of work on this mummy in the last week, and before we get to what I think it is, as far as the South American people are concerned, there's a lot of people here believing that this is true, that this is an authentic Inca mummy, a Nazca mummy, that there's a whole faction of people who want to believe that it's extraterrestrial. There's a lot of believers down here, you know, 70 or 80% of South America believe in UFOs. So there's a lot of high hopes in this mummy, a lot of high hopes.
Mm-hmm. When you say 80 plus percent believe in UFOs, is that because there's so much, so many sightings? Is there so much activity around that? I mean, that's an interesting statement you made.
It is, but I'm not going to give you the answer you maybe want, but this is what I put this down to. I think when you live in a country with 98% of Catholics, mm-hmm. there is a great tendency for people to believe in supernatural subjects. Mm-hmm. It's part of the ethos, the belief system, and I think belief comes easy in this continent. However, back marrying with that is just what you've said. There are an extraordinary amount of UFO sightings and whatnot in the mountains, especially in Costa Rica and here where I am in Colombia. I mean, I live across the road, across the park from Hoyga, where there's more UFOs and orb sightings above this mountain than any other mountain in South America. I haven't seen anything myself yet, but it's certainly not for the lack of looking.
That's kind of interesting. Okay, well, what do you read about this this mummy? And now, I'm still holding back my opinions, other than to say, if it is a fake, it's got to be one of the best ever made. I mean, someone spent millions and millions of dollars on it. I don't think it's a fake. I think it's the real McCoy. But what are you reading? What do you think?
Here's the thing. So tomorrow on AshleyCowie.com, I'm publishing a featured article about a discovery, an observation I've made in this mummy. So let's assume, right, for a moment that this is not a modern hoax. Let's say this is a 5th century Nazca mummy, okay? Mm-hmm. I haven't taken that assumption and gone and had a look, and I've uncovered quite a lot of petroglyphs, carvings, and artwork, Nazca artwork, that depict three-fingered gods and three-toed gods. And if, as I say, assuming for a moment this is original, what I think we're looking at are Aztec shamans altering a human corpse by taking away the big toe, the little toe, small finger and thumb, realigning the bones, adding animal bones, and stitching it back up. I think we're looking at what could be 1600-year-old plastic surgery, if you like, reconstructive surgery, to create a mummy that looks like their shamanic god. Now, let me just further this.
Dude.
I'm going to tell you this. So here's the thing is, right, Ash, so let's assume that your theory's right, that the shamans, 1600 years ago, altered a human corpse to look like a god or to look like an animal. Why would they do this? Well, a very, very central part in shamanism is a transistory, a transmutation process where the shaman takes on the apparition of an animal. That mummy is halfway between a sloth and a human. It has sloth feet and toes. It has a sloth-shaped skull, but it's human. I wonder if it's a shaman who is involved in rites relating to the indigenous sloth. What do you think about that?
That's the first time I've heard anyone suggest that there was surgical procedures done on this figure.
Cliff, here's the thing, buddy, and I'm going to tell you it's in my blog article tomorrow. I've got a doctor from Glasgow University. He's looked at the feet. I don't know if you've noticed this, but the two feet are different. Here's the thing I've discovered. On the left foot, the joint for the big toe has a small toe attached to it. On the right foot, the joint for the big toe has a big toe attached to it. There was two people creating this thing. They did not correctly communicate their starting points. They've misaligned a toe. And I'm going to tell you now, the doctor is going to say that this creature did not walk. Why? Because there's no compensatory damage on the right knees to compensate for the bad toe. It couldn't have moved.
Huh.
And that's what's coming out tomorrow. There's a misaligned toe. It was man done. It's the second toe is against the big toe on one foot, and it's correct in the second foot, which shows human error in design, which convinced. And I've got this doctor also saying that the length of the feet compared to the length of the legs, it would have had to have taken 4-inch steps. It would have been a useless creature, if you like.
That was my next question to you, is that if the feet were realigned somehow cosmetically, how did this thing walk? That no one's brought that up except for Gaia. Gaia actually has a animation of how the creature may have walked, but you're saying that this is just somebody manipulating bones and never meant to actually function.
No, I think this is somebody has that a great shaman has died, a shaman who aligned himself with that animal in particular, the three-fingered sloth, three-toed sloth. And that this isn't just me. I mean, this was common practice. They were doing that as far north as Mexico, you know, this shamanic transitionary period where they take form of a local indigenous animal. A shaman dies, they quite simply take away the small toes, the big toe, the big thing, the thumbs, and they stitch it back up. There's not a lot of alteration there. In fact, to back this up, you can even see the cuff of where the wrist meets the three bones of the three fingers of the hand. It's quite clear that the large and small appendages have been removed, and that it's been, so they've ballsed up the alignments of the toes. But then I imagine a modern hoaxer, that accident would never have happened. It's quite possibly happened 1600 years ago outside a cave, you know, when they're actually. And so, which leads me to believe, if this thing is original, but what's incredible, Cliff, is that there's just the one other thing. You know, no one's discovered anything like this. I'm going to show an article tomorrow that Peru is littered with the Nazca crafts and arts with three-fingered, three-toed gods. It's not just that one petroglyph at Nazca.
Right.
Their entire cosmology was filled with them.
Okay, I heard that from my source that there's a number of these mummies that have been discovered, and that's the next step, is we're going to see a couple of these guys. I also saw a video yesterday from Jaime Masson, who's a Mexican reporter, and he's known for UFO stuff, but he's not necessarily the most reliable individual, and he has reported on a collection of smaller entities that have three fingers and three toes. So he's suggesting a whole race of these beings being out there. So that's what's really kind of crazy.
Yeah, and that is, again, all based on the premise that these were creatures that could walk. But, I've looked at the science of it. I've had medical opinion on it. The geometry of the feet compared to the legs, it couldn't have walked. And there's no compensatory damage. We've got a misaligned left toe. It would have walked with a hobble, a limp. There would be massive compensatory damage on the right hips and knees, and there's just nothing. And of course, but I don't think that, as I say, a modern hoaxer would make that error.
Yeah.
I think that points towards it being a mummy of Nazca origin is what it's pointing towards. But the big question comes then is, why have we only found the one? But if you say there's a host of them coming out, that would be super interesting.
Yeah.
But what worries me, Cliff, is that the people surrounding this discovery, it's like Professor Xavier's X-Men, right? You know, all the four lead scientists have all been involved in hoaxes and UFO discoveries in the past.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, to me, UFO spotters always see UFOs, Bigfoot hunters always gather Bigfoot fur, and devil worshippers always feel Satan.
Let me ask you this. The people in Colombia that have heard about this, or people in neighboring countries, perhaps Peru, what are they saying in the newspapers? It must be all over the newspapers.
Yeah, the trouble you got us here is that the people who are interested, who just like skirting on the internet, are fascinated with it. But you do have to bear in mind, 4 days, the director of culture of the Nazca, director of culture for Nazca, was approached about it. It's on YouTube. It's not got as many hits as the Gaia video, but he was basically, he gave four words, and I think the translation is es carta de la muerte. Basically, he said, it's all a load of bullshit.
Ah.
That's head cultural director for Nazca. I won't even comment on it. He's just saying, look, give it a few weeks and it's gone. So you've got that in all the main nationals and newspapers and stuff. So people are just sort of, it's all a bit of a joke at the moment. But, you know, the beliefs, the hardcore, it's the smoking gun for either a new race or extraterrestrial origins.
Yeah. Well, so I'll tell you, it's sure cool to look at the hands. I look at the hands are what's really amazing to me. And if somebody figured out a way to sew them together, or put them all together in some kind of one complete hand, they did a hell of a job.
I think, to be honest with you, when you look at it, right, the body, all of the proportions of the body are identical. They're human. There's nothing out of place. The skull's elongated, but that was a common practice. All that's really been done is the big thumb, the two thumbs, the two small fingers, and again on the feet, have been taken away. And three extra bones have been added. It's not actually a big job. I'll tell you what does come back. The question that I've got in my head is, to complete this theory, is, so they're adding length to the fingers and the feet. Where did the extra skin come from? That's a bit dark.
Yeah, that is weird. Very strange. Okay,
yeah.
Well, hey, we wanted to get your point of view, and I think we'll be done with this after this week. Either way, I'm going to pull away and move on to some other things. I always want to get your point of view, Ashley, simply because you're down there in the thick of it, and you can provide your perspective on what people are saying in your neck of the woods.
Yep. I am your ears in South America, my friend.
Okay, Ash, you take it easy, and we'll come back to you and discuss something new and exciting next week.
Great stuff. Look forward to it. Cheers, Cliff.
So that's Ashley Cowie down in Colombia, South America. And, you know, that he is right in the thick of it. And he's a scientist, and he's looking at these things. And, you know, he cuts to the chase and basically says he thinks it's an alteration. I don't know. I mean, I still am waiting to hear from Gaia my sponsor, because Gaia was the one that actually sent the scientists down there. So we will hear from them shortly. So here we go. This is an interview I did with my sponsor, the producers, the people, the organization that funded the research for the discovery of this this mummy. This is my talk with Melissa Tittle, and she is one of the many people who actually was working with the mummy, and this is what she had to say. So many of you have been hearing me, been listening to me talk about this mummy, this Nazca mummy in Peru. I've had a couple of people on. I had Ashley Cowie speak about it. He's in Colombia. Everyone's writing it off. Everybody's saying, no, can't be, can't be. I am very fortunate to have the producer at Gaia on with me. Her name is Melissa Tittle, and she is the director of original content at Gaia, to tell us all about the details of this discovery. Melissa, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. I'm glad I could join you today.
I am too. I mean, I'm really happy that we can get kind of to the focal point of this, because everyone's guessing at this point. So let's start from the top. Where was this mummy discovered?
As we understand it, the mummy was found in a tomb near Nazca, but we don't know the exact location. The guy that found the mummy hasn't been able to share that with us. And, you know, we're under the understanding that his name is Mario, but we don't even know if that is his real name. So okay. At the moment, we don't have the exact location, but we know that it was in a tomb near Nazca.
Okay. When you say tomb, was it revealed to you that this was like a burial for a figure? Was there other individuals in there? Or was this just a typical burial for somebody who lived, you know, over 800 years ago?
From my understanding, it's a cave. And
okay.
You know, the thing is that I hope that we get to go there. I mean, everything is you know, in progress as we speak. But, you know, I hear these things that it's this cave that has all these tunnels and all these pathways and other rooms. And apparently this body called Maria was found in this tomb alongside some other bodies as well.
Okay. Now, you produced a short video called Nazca Unearthing. And in the video, you actually show the mummy. You show a lot of references to it, which are like artifacts, beings with three fingers. What is the general age that has come back with the initial dating on this thing?
Well, the carbon dating that we got was from 245 AD to 410 AD. We are, of course, testing this multiple times because, you know, we don't just take one test and say,
right,
that's it. That's how old it is. And just today, we got another test back from our carbon dating lab, and it came out to be virtually the same date. It was 249 AD to 411 AD. So, you know, we're going to get this tested
that
a couple times.
Yeah. What is the rough? What's the rough age?
1700 years ago.
Yeah, that's pretty old.
Yeah, I mean, it's not
that's
new.
True.
I mean,
yeah.
You're telling me. I mean, I'm, you know, Gaia's role in this is really taking a scientific approach as much as we can. So, you know, I call all of these forensic places trying to get things tested, you know, as far as DNA and of course,
right,
the white powder on the body that everybody's fascinated about. And I'm like, I have this dead body. It's a mummy. And I want to,
yeah,
get it tested. And they're like, okay, do you have a police number? or case number, I mean. So I think, again, we're going to keep getting this carbon dated, keep getting tests back just to keep checking the samples that we have and to see if there's any other lab that has another opinion. But right now, the second testing has come back virtually the same time period.
Okay. That's actually great. Okay, now let's talk about this actual mummy physically. It is humanoid. It has three fingers, and these are very interesting fingers. It has three toes, but you actually did a very basic animation of what it may have looked like when it was alive. It's being, he was about 5 foot six, very long fingers, very long toes. I mean, that must just be a mind blower to consider that.
You mean the actual size of the being, or what's mind-blowing?
The actual being. I mean, he's got three long fingers, and this is a humanoid. I mean, it's not. It's an actual being. Is that correct? It's an actual humanoid that we don't know about. It doesn't fit in any of our evolutionary patterns, as far as you can tell.
That is correct. But, you know, we don't know what it is. That's the thing. And I think, like, you know, I just want to stress this enough. You know, I don't think that anybody here is jumping to conclusions on what it could be. It looks human. I mean, the body, right? Torso, and that looks human. Of course, the fingers and the toes do not. The head's elongated. The face looks a little different. But I don't want to really speculate. I think that it's all about getting the data back and finding out what it is, like how it lived. I mean, because you look at those three toes and the three fingers and you're thinking, like, well, how did they use them? You know, how did they walk? I mean, it's like bird feet, or were they webbed? I don't know. I mean, these are all things that we're talking to scientific people about and getting things tested to find the answers. And, you know, I don't want to speculate what it could be. I mean,
I have to say, though, you did a great job in the video in a comparative study. You actually have artifacts and weaving and some pottery where you actually show that there could have been beings at that location and that time frame that had three fingers. I mean, that was something that you brought forward. Now, was that something that was to help people realize that these may have been Earth-based beings at some point? And what was the thought behind that?
Actually, our crew, you know, you have to understand that we went down there not knowing what we were going to see. And when we got to see it, we were like, we don't know what that is. And it just so happened that when we were there, we just realized that there was artwork and pictures of beings with three fingers. It's kind of incorporated into styles, if you will. It's not like we would have noticed that otherwise. So it was just kind of strange that, and I think that happens a lot in the subconscious of symbols. People just keep drawing or making symbols and using them without knowing where they came from. And it's just kind of unusual, but kind of fits the area. And so you have to ask yourself, you're like, why would they have artwork with these beings with three fingers? It's kind of ironic and unusual.
Yeah, it's totally, totally interesting. Have any other mummies been found in that general vicinity?
Yes, there's other mummies that have been found. There are some smaller creatures. They look a little bit different than Maria, besides the size that they're smaller. They're just built a little bit differently. And we are actually going to air a new update with this smaller body that we got to really dissect. That'll be next week, so that's kind of exciting.
Okay, yeah, we'll have to definitely run that. Was there any clothing or artifacts around the mummy when it was exhumed?
Not that I know of. I mean, we have not been to the tomb. I'd love to go to the tomb, but as I know it today, there has been none of that.
Okay. And I think the last question I kind of have for you is, what is this glaze, this white glaze that makes the mummy appear like it's a clay? I mean, that really throw a lot of people off, I think, when they see
like a 3D print image, like Plaster of Paris. Yes.
Exactly.
Hey, look, you know, again, again, we don't know what this is. Human, non-human, is it a hoax? That's why we're really trying to stick to the scientific data, because this could be big or this could be just a hoax, right? I don't know what that white powder is. I have to tell you, I was completely not convinced when I first got there. And then when we really got to dissect the body, like take the samples and kind of see that this was some kind of possible organic creature,
yeah,
I just thought to myself, okay, well, I don't know what that white stuff is, but we're going to get it tested. And we are definitely getting it tested. So as soon as those results come out to what it could be, because it is a little bit unusual, when you look at other mummies, you're not like, wow, that's usually not that white, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah, I know. Again, yeah. Like, you know, I feel the same way. But there is something real on that body. I mean, it is organic in places, you know, but I don't... The white powder is definitely getting tested because it's one of my main concerns because I've never seen anything like that before.
Okay. Bottom line, is this an alien we're looking at?
Again, speculation. I don't know. I don't know. Could be.
It's cool.
Could be a deformity in an evolution. I mean, sometimes you go through evolution, but then you have de-evolution. And that's things that geneticists talk about and even DNA specialists. It happens in some animal species. That could be a case here. Or it could be from another planet. We don't know.
Exactly.
I mean, all of it, again, is up for speculation, but fascinating. And I just think that the scientific data that we're going to be getting is just fascinating, whatever it could be.
Yeah. We're looking forward to hearing more from Gaia. Melissa Tittle, thank you very much. I appreciate you giving us some time on this. And I'm hoping that it's the real McCoy. And I, from what I've seen you produce in the x-rays and the scans, it looks pretty authentic to me.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely something there. Yeah, and the thing is, at this point, now that doesn't mean... In the future, we will get tests back that, you know, someone says this is XYZ. But at this point, all the experts we are talking to, whether they're in other countries or they're here in the United States, they cannot find any reason for it to be a hoax yet. You know, everyone's still kind of like there's something here. So we'll just have to hold tight to see what that is.
Okay. Hey, one last final mm-hmm. question is, are you guys going to do a special program around it, or is it going to be more of just your take on it as an anomalous subject?
We're just releasing updates as they come in. Is that what you mean by a program?
Yeah, I mean you could do a whole show around it, you know, like Ancient Aliens.
Yeah.
It could be a Gaia special.
Well, I mean, that could happen in the future where we put everything together in one long documentary. But the thing with documentaries, unlike Ancient Aliens, which I used to produce, is that, you know, they take a while because you gotta gather all the evidence. So we're just putting pieces out there as soon as we get it so that we can share it with people. And then, you know, that would be a great idea. Hopefully we can put it all together into some amazing documentary.
Well, I mean, you guys are spending some serious money on getting this tested, so I would think it would be an outcome for you to have an exclusive on it. No one else is doing the work you're doing, correct?
Not that I know of. I mean, there is you know, there's some other people doing scientific testing. I mean, I know that Jaime Musson kind of has his own thing, his scientific testing, and then we have Terry and. But I think like everyone has their own take. I think our take at Gaia is like, let's just stick to the facts. I mean, we have all sorts of programming here at Gaia, right? We have like really right. out there stuff and we have, you know, kind of mainstream transformational stuff. But for the most part, with this, because it's so different, we're really, really sticking to the facts. So that's our take on it. What other people are doing is their take.
Hey, that's I appreciate that look at it. More scientific than speculative. All right. Hey, Melissa,
yeah.
Thank you. And hopefully we can check back with you in the coming weeks to determine the bottom line on the details and the science.
Definitely. Yeah, let's make this a weekly call. What do you think?
Hey, I love that. I totally love that. Okay.
I hope we have something to say every week. But thank you so much, and have a great night.
So that was Melissa from Gaia. And as it turns out, we are going to have her representing Gaia each week with a short little segment on some new programming. Gaia puts out a tremendous amount of new content every week. Every month there's a new series that's uploaded and produced. And if you haven't been to their site, you got to check it out. Gaia.com/Earth Ancients. And check out the two series that have been created so far on Maria, as they're calling her, Maria the Mummy. Now, this is news to me. I didn't have a clue that it was a female. But Maria the Mummy, part one and part two are on Gaia. Gaia.com/Earth Ancients. Pay the 99 cents and jump on there and check it out. Okay, so there you go. That is the latest details on this mummy. All the speculation, all the arguments, they are the ones that are right there with their team. And we're going to hear more about it in hopefully soon as to the authenticity of this mummy with three fingers. So this week, the subject is American giants. Now, we've had a number of people talking about giants on the program. David Brody is our guest today, and he is a well-known author, an award-winning author, and we're talking about a new book that he wrote called The Oath of Nimrod, Giants, MK Ultra, and the Smithsonian Cover-Up. So I think you're going to like this interview. And I'll come back at the end of it and talk a little bit about what's going on for next week. So the topic this week is American giants. And we haven't talked about giants in, Jesus, it seems like months, if not a year. And our guest today brings a different perspective that I really liked. Our guest is David Brody. David is a Boston Globe bestselling fiction writer, author of 9 novels. He's the former director of the New England Antiquities Research Association and a dedicated researcher in the subject of pre-Columbian exploration of America. He's been on History Channel, Travel Channel, and interesting enough, he's written 6 books on the Templars. And the book we're going to talk about today is The Oath of Nimrod, Giants, MK Ultra, and the Smithsonian Cover-Up. David, how you doing?
Doing great, Cliff. I appreciate being on the show.
Yeah, great to have you on. I was just kind of reviewing your book a little bit, and I think the audience needs to know that the book, although based on a lot of facts, is a book of fiction.
Right.
But in the back, you do highlight a lot of the information that you've collected. So why don't you tell us first? I'm always curious about authors researching in books. What brought up the giant aspect of this book? Because that's our focus today, and that was my interest. What was was there something that you had read in the work of the Templars that was based on giants? I mean, where does the beginning start for you?
Right. So in researching the Templars, I eventually ended up with the Phoenicians because there's some interesting tie-ins when the Templars ended up in the Middle East during the Crusade period. They were immediately befriended and made allies with a small group of Lebanese Christians that had descended from the ancient seafaring Phoenicians. And many people believe that it was the Lebanese, the Phoenician descendants, who provided the Templars with the maps and charts and navigational skill to get across the Atlantic. And so when you start looking at the Phoenicians, and we'll get into this as we get along in our discussion today, Cliff, we start getting into some interesting tie-ins with the giants. And so as I'm down in that rabbit hole, ferreting around, researching the Templars, I kept bumping into Phoenicians, giants, and then Ancient American Magazine, which I'm a longtime subscriber of, periodically talks about these burial mounds. And then, of course, Jim Vieira's research. Jim is a member of New England Antiquities Research Association, NERA, out here in New England, which I'm a member of, and I've heard his lectures. And I just started reading some of the stuff he researched, and then I ended up appearing on his show a couple times. And, you know, it's one of those things where there's that – my old hockey coach used to say, where there's that many beer cans lying around, son, there might have been some drinking going on. And there's just a lot of evidence of this ancient civilization of oversized humans. Maybe we shouldn't use the term giants all the time, but oversized humans. And, you know, that's my training. I'm a lawyer by trade, and so I'm trained to analyze and weigh and investigate evidence, try to reach conclusions based on that evidence. And so that's what I do in my novels. They are fiction, but I base them on, you know, historical reality, historical facts, actual artifacts, actual sites, actual evidence. And I try to make it so it's a bit of a roller coaster ride, but at their core, these are books about hidden history, ancient hidden history that – you know, we're trying to uncover and learn about.
Now, one of the things I thought was quite interesting about your research and what you cover in your book is this period of time. I'd call it the mid-1800s. And there seemed to be a great deal of research, not only on these mound builders, but uncovering giants. In fact, it was in such a... so much of the public's mind during these 1800s, 1840s, that even the president, Lincoln, had something. I want to quote here from your book. Abraham Lincoln quotes, this is 1848. He says, "The eyes of extinct giants whose bones fill the mounds of America have gazed on Niagara Falls just as our eyes do now." I mean, for the president to say something like that means that this is in the news constantly, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was very matter of fact, and I think it's important when we talk about giants. You know, we're talking somewhere less than 12 feet, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 feet. We're not talking 15 to 20 feet. So, you know, at some point, physiologically, it becomes impossible. But, yeah, so there's a couple of things going on. One is that, you know, pretty much every time you turn around, some newspaper account was writing about a pioneering farmer, you know, digging up a field and finding giant skeletons and having the judge and the surgeon come out and documenting this 9, 10, 11-foot human skeleton. So it's all the time. And then secondly, these people are reading the Bible. And, of course, in the Bible, there are many references to giants. And so the combination of present-day newspaper and the ancient biblical records, it was very much assumed that, yeah, one or both of these, probably both of these sources were true. And so, you know, we look at it today and sort of roll our eyes and say giants. But I think during the time of Lincoln, as you mentioned, and you know, for the entire century of the 19th century, it was very much understood that at some point there was an ancient race or tribe of oversized humans. We'll call them giants.
Right. No, it's funny. You refer to Jim Vieira's book, who co-wrote with Hugh Newman the giant book. And he documents 1,500 separate articles on giants. Now, a good portion of those are from this period, right around the 1840s.
So that's sort of the sweet spot, mid-1800s, but they go back to the early 1800s and all the way to the early 1900s. And, you know, basically as pioneers came across the country and started, whether it was digging for, you know, building the railroads or more often just farming, these stories happen all the time. There's some kind of mound, and we'll get into the burial mounds, I'm sure, later. But in these mounds, they would dig up these human skeletons, and they, you know, they would call the local surgeon out, and they would measure these things and take some pictures later on, and display the bones in town hall. And, of course, eventually the bones would just, decay, but ashes to ashes. And so that's why we don't have them anymore. But and so this was, figure 1800 to about 1920 seems to be the span of these. But like you said, mid-1800s is the sweet spot.
Yeah. You know, the thing that's interesting about this, and we cannot help but bring up the name of the Smithsonian Institute whenever we talk about giant bones, because they seem to be complicit in collecting, in going out and rummaging and actually doing some digs on their own, being a part of this whole phenomenon of giants and giant remains, giant artifacts. Is it your understanding that they had kind of a goal in preserving this legacy of giants? Or, I mean, most of the writing that I hear about and I understand is that they were not necessarily an institution that wanted to put these things on display.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Now, whether there was some of an active conspiracy, I'm not willing to go that far. We don't have the evidence for that. But I think that there was, whether you call it willful neglect or just indifference, clearly the idea that there was some kind of ancient race of peoples here, European, you know, non-Native American race, was contrary to what the Smithsonian was trying to teach and to preserve as far as the nation's history. The whole idea of manifest destiny, that the European settlers had a God-given right to settle the entire country and to displace the Native Americans, that assumption, that presumption, would be undermined if it turns out there were other peoples here before the European settlers that we call our founding fathers, okay? So that whole narrative that there might have been, you know, Phoenician explorers, European explorers, other explorers, and settlers that were here before us, that would undermine the whole idea that we have the right to take the land from the Native Americans. And so evidence that tended to support that, you know, I'm not going to say it was covered up, but it clearly wasn't highlighted and trumpeted. And so what we see is a lot of this evidence, a lot of these bones, and a lot of these skeletons were, by the way, documented by Smithsonian researchers, you know, in the Bureau of Ethnology, for example. I've got a report from 1894 documenting a giant skeleton. So a lot of times this was the Smithsonian itself that was documenting these finds and taking the bones, but they have, for whatever reason, gone missing. They're just not in their collection anymore. A lot of the records seem to be gone. Is it benign neglect? Was it willful misconduct? You know, I don't know. But the result is we don't have a lot of the evidence. We don't have a lot of the bones.
Do you find it odd that, this is some recent information that I got, those who are in charge of ancient American artifacts at the Smithsonian have basically said, hey, we don't have anything. It was thrown away. It's destroyed. We have nothing. When they say that to you, are you suspicious? Or do you basically say, well, that makes sense to me?
I think everyone thinks of that final scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, where the thing goes, the ark goes into the bowels of the Smithsonian archives, you know, never to be found again. And so who knows what they have? I know that we've had some frustrating times trying to research the Bat Creek Stone, which doesn't really relate to giants, but it's a Cherokee burial mound, and some artifacts were found, and the Cherokee tribe has asked for them to be returned by the Smithsonian, and the Smithsonian says, sorry, we don't have them. And it's very frustrating because really the one job the Smithsonian has is to preserve the nation's history, right? That's their job. And so when you give them stuff, you expect they at least won't lose it. And when they do, you can't help but sort of say, well, you know, really? You lost it? Like, you know, it's not my grandmother's attic. You know, you guys are supposed to be the Smithsonian. So it's hard because I think there's so much stuff there, and you know, hundreds of years worth of stuff. And at one point, this was considered probably not that important. And so, did it just get thrown away? Did it get misfiled? Did it actually decay? The bones not decay because they weren't climate controlled. You know, I don't know if we're ever going to know the answer to that. It's similar to the Vatican archives. I mean, who knows what's in those archives?
Yeah, which is sad because there's. You know, especially with the Smithsonian Institute, if they did have these massive human bones, it would really be wonderful to know about because it is a part of American history, early American history. It was written about. It was, there's been books obviously written about, but this was part of, I don't know how you can categorize it, but a phenomenon in early American
right.
culture. So.
But in the Native Americans, yeah, it's not just written about by quote unquote European sources, but the Native American oral history talks about this race of giants, and there was constant battles, and you know, eventually the tribes merged, but for a long time the giant tribe, quote unquote, ruled much of the Ohio River Valley, which is where we find a lot of them. And so I think we need to be more diligent about looking at our Native American oral history as well, because let's face it, they were the ones that were here. I mean, the only people that really know what happened was the Native Americans.
Right. Very interesting. Let's go back to the beginning and your research. You believe that this giant race was associated with the Phoenicians. That's interesting. Well, it's a theory, but I mean, you write pretty strongly about it. Now, let's say the Phoenicians came to the Americas, North America, around 3,000 years ago. Why were they coming to this continent?
Right. So in analyzing the evidence, it's sort of the intersection point, as you mentioned, is about 3,000 years ago, maybe a little bit sooner, maybe 700 BC, 2,700 years ago. But we have an intersection point of a lot of interesting things happening going on, starting with a site up in New Hampshire called America Stonehenge, which I believe and other researchers believe was built by the ancient Phoenicians who were here to trade for and mine for copper. We know that they were traveling as far as southern England to Cornwall to get tin, and you needed tin and copper to make bronze during the Bronze Age. And the Bronze Age ended about 600 BC. So if we go back about 27, 28, 29, 3,000 years ago, we're still in the Bronze Age.
Right.
Many historians believe the Phoenicians had seafaring ability. We know they circumnavigated Africa. They sailed by the stars. It seems to me, most compelling of all is, again, the Native American sources tell us that in ancient times, European or Mediterranean traders came to the Great Lakes region and mined the float copper, and this is going back 2,000-3,000 years ago. Again, the copper was needed to combine with the tin to make the bronze in the Bronze Age. We don't otherwise have enough sources of copper to supply all the copper that was needed during the Bronze Age. You know, they're making weaponry and ornamentation and tools. There's huge amounts of metal would have been needed. So the idea that the Phoenicians, who were already up in the North Atlantic in the British Isles, either accidentally or on purpose, crossed the Atlantic and ended up first in New England, and then they made their way up through Quebec and into the Great Lakes, that all sort of makes sense, and there's a lot of evidence for that. The site in New Hampshire, America Stonehenge, has some interesting evidence supporting that, not the least of which is a carving in an ancient Phoenician script that's called the Baal Stone. It reads, "To Baal of the Canaanites." And the Canaanites were the ancient peoples of Lebanon, and the name of the Phoenicians is what the Phoenicians, what other people call, oh, sorry, what the Phoenicians called themselves was the Canaanites. And so evidence that the Phoenicians / Canaanites had been to the America Stonehenge site somewhere 2,500 to 3,000 years ago. So again, we have this intersection point of these things going on. The Bronze Age is occurring, the Phoenician exploration. They were sort of at the height of their trading around 3,000 years ago. The Baal Stone at America Stonehenge is in that time period. And then these burial mounds, the Adena culture burial mounds, are around 1,000 B.C. to about 200 B.C., so there's an intersection point there. And so what I think would happen was, if you look at the Phoenicians and you look at the old biblical text, the giants of the Bible, Og, for example, lived in the mountains of Lebanon, which is where the Phoenicians lived. So the Phoenicians coming over here to mine copper and trade for copper, it makes sense to me that they would have brought their biggest, strongest guys, their giants. And if they did, some of them probably would have stayed. And those are the giants that we see spread apart, spread across the Ohio River Valley, the Great Lakes region, New England. So I think that's how the giants first came to America on the Phoenician trading ships about, as you said, 2,800 years ago.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about these European giants. What else do we know about them? I mean, if the Phoenicians befriended this group, maybe they had been friends before. It's funny you mentioned Lebanon. Lebanon is an area that has a lot of anomalous stoneworks. Baalbek is best known for these huge, monstrous wall stones that weigh 1,000 tons. And there's great speculation as how in the hell they got those put into place because they're so huge. So
I think even the largest giant would not have been able to do that. But yeah, the Baltic site's amazing. But you're right.
Yeah.
There's an intersection point there of a lot of strange things going on.
Yeah.
Let's, if I could just drop a footnote here and talk about when we're talking about these giants, as I mentioned earlier, we're not talking 15, 20 feet because at some point the human physiology just doesn't let that happen. But the Bible in Samuel, the book of Samuel, for example, it talks about Goliath 6 cubits in a span, which is about 9.5 feet. And so I think that's sort of what we're talking about here, that Og, the king of Bashan, same kind of height generalization. So we're talking 8, 9, 10, 11 feet is what we're talking here. So not big enough to lift the massive foundation stones of Baalbek, but clearly big enough to be referred to as giants, both in the Bible and by pioneers.
Mm-hmm. And was it? Is there any place in your research where we talk about a king, a giant king in Lebanon, or knowledge of a specific people? I mean, the Bible does kind of reference it, but there's no specifics in terms of names that I can remember that are specified in the Bible. Did you come across an agreement where the Phoenicians would take the giants to America? Or, I mean, there's a great deal of speculation because here they are, they kind of appear.
Right. This is me playing connect the dots and saying, you know, these Phoenicians lived in the mountains of Lebanon. We know that. They used the cedar trees to build their ships. And this is also where the Bible tells us that these Og, the king of Bashan. Bashan is the hills of Lebanon. So, you know, whether they were the same people or they were neighboring peoples, again, I'm playing a little bit of connect the dots there. It makes sense that they assuming that they had good relations, that they would have brought these massive people with them. If you're going to be mining copper, you need strong guys. You know, just sort of common sense. You need good warriors. And so the Bible talks. The Bible does not talk about mining for copper. It does not talk about going to North America, but it does talk regularly about these race of giants in that area.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. Now we don't have. They didn't have carbon dating in the 1800s when they started exhuming these bodies. But is there any evidence of any of these artifacts that are in local museums, like in Ohio? From these mounds in terms of their dates?
So the one that's most interesting is something called the Grave Creek Burial Mound in West Virginia. And the reason that's interesting is because there's a giant buried there. He's about 7.5 feet. And underneath his head, underneath the skeleton, is an inscription on a stone. It's called the Grave Creek Tablet. Many scholars believe it's Phoenician writing, and it's been translated by one as, quote, burial mound in honor of King Tasach. His queen caused this tablet to be inscribed. So what we have there, assuming this translation is correct, is we have an ancient giant in a burial mound in the Ohio River Valley with Phoenician script. So that's a really sort of a direct tie into all the things I'm talking about there. Now, those bones, we don't have those bones anymore, unfortunately, to be carbon dated. And the question I think you're getting at is, you know, why do we not have any of these bones left? And part of the issue is that I believe it was 1990, the Native American Grave Repatriation Act, NAGPRA, was passed. And it made it illegal for anyone to have, I'll use the term Native American bones or funeral artifacts. And so what's happened is there's probably a lot of these bones that are in collections, private collections, but they've gone underground because no one wants to get put in jail or arrested for this kind of stuff. There was that case a couple of years ago, the collector in Indiana who was showing his collection of ancient artifacts, and the FBI raided his home. And so, you know, nobody wants to be the next guy that had that happen to them. And so there may be giant bones. There's plenty of private museums that used to be in operation in the 70s and 80s that had these bones. And again, they've all gone underground after NAGPRA was passed.
That's a good point. No one wants to get thrown in jail for letting people look at their artifacts. Yeah, that's an issue. Hey, you just made an interesting statement. You were reading from the decipherment of the stone, and in it, it said the queen is acknowledging the king. That's European talk. That's not Native American talk, which is very, very interesting to my mind. Kings and queens are something that has happened in the old world, not the new world.
That's a good pickup. I had not noticed that, Cliff. That's a really good insight. But I think what would happen was if these giants were here, if the Phoenicians were here, some of them would have stayed. It's only natural. They would have been here on, you know, for a long time, over many winters. They would eventually have taken native wives. They would have stayed. The biggest, strongest guys may have been elevated to royalty, kingship, or the biggest, strongest guys would have married the chief's daughter somehow, the princess or whatever. But yeah, that term king and queen, you're right, that's a very European sounding term. And so another sort of, and what I find with all of this is we don't have the one smoking gun piece of evidence. What we have is 10 or 12 or 15 pieces of good circumstantial evidence, and together we cobble together a case. Again, this is my training as a lawyer. And so it'd be nice if we had that one, you know, 8.5-foot bone with Phoenician DNA that goes back to 2,700 years ago in a burial mound in Ohio. Bingo. We can, you know, game, set, and match right there. We don't have that, unfortunately. So we're left with still trying to put together a case as best we can.
Right. You mentioned the American Stonehenge in New Hampshire as a probable site, possibly giants. Was there something about that location and the way the buildings are put together that made you think it could be a giant encampment of some kind?
Yeah, I don't think that's a giant encampment as much as it's clearly a ceremonial, religious site. To me, the strongest evidence indicates it was Phoenician. Let me back up. Undoubtedly, in my mind, it was built by a sun worshipping people, the sun god Baal. Okay, and that inscription that we found to Baal of the Canaanites, you know, confirms that. And there's a sacrificial stone in the center of that site that indicates that those people sacrificed animals and perhaps even humans, probably to the sun god. And there's some fascinating alignments on the summer solstice sunrise, in which the site in New Hampshire aligns back directly to the Stonehenge site in England, which in turn aligns directly back to a site in the Golan Heights in Israel called Israeli Stonehenge, which used to be part of southern Lebanon. And it's almost like these Stonehenge sites were reverse engineered by the Phoenicians, the Canaanites, to link back to their homeland on the summer solstice, which would have been the most important day of the year for a sun-worshipping culture. And so the things about America Stonehenge that indicate to me it was built by the Phoenicians are these reverse engineering aspects, the way it does tie back, the alignments tie back directly to the other two Stonehenge sites, England, of course, being the most famous, and then the recently discovered one called the Wheel of Giants in the Golan Heights in Israel, in northern Israel. There are some aspects of the America Stonehenge site that make you think they had to have some pretty strong guys. I mean, some of the stones in the Oracle Chamber are about 45 tons, which is not nearly as big as Baalbek, but it's as big as most of the stones in the King's Chamber in Giza Pyramids, which go from about 25 to 80 tons. So when you start seeing people move stuff around like that, you know it's not just for a farm or for a root cellar or something utilitarian. It takes too much effort. Those kinds of things are almost always ceremonial or religious when you really want to impress your gods. And so there are some people who believe the America Stonehenge site was built by colonial farmers. I mean, to get there, you have to ignore a lot of DNA evidence and a lot of other really common sense stuff. But most compelling of all, no farmer is going to move a 45-ton slab around just to make a root cellar. It just makes no sense. But if you're doing it for religious reasons, you want to impress your gods, okay, that starts to make some sense.
Mm-hmm. Did you find any evidence in any of these mounds of anomalous types of configurations or connection to Europe? As an example, probably the most famous mound that I can think about is in Ohio. It's the Serpent Mound, which is extremely sophisticated in so many ways. They've just detected and they've run scans over it, and it's right on top of a geomagnetic field that pulses up the lyric energy. People see all kinds of weird stuff there, and they feel really weird energy. It's like, it's almost, it's so anomalous. It's a freak. It's really a strange, kind of a freaky thing.
And just the fact that it's a serpent, the fact that it's a snake, when you think about how in Judeo-Christian culture, how the snake is considered so evil, you know, the Adam and Eve story, and
right.
Everybody has that reaction to the snake in modern times, but in ancient times, it was considered the symbol of wisdom. We still see it today on the American Medical Association with the rod of Asclepius, you know, the snake going around the rod, and how that the ancient symbol of wisdom, and how Isis used to worship the snake in Egypt. But in modern times, the snake is considered to be the representation almost of the devil. That obviously tells us that the serpent mound in the Edina burial mound in Ohio, you know, no one thinks it was built by Christians. Okay, we understand that, but it does help us get back to a time period that was pre-Christian, at a time when cultures did worship the snake, and again, that gets us back to, you know, 2,500, 3,000 years ago. There's nothing about that site that directly links to giants, other than the time period would have been similar to a time when we think the Phoenicians and other Middle Eastern travelers may have been over here, and it might have been that they brought their snake worship, which was going on in the Middle East at that time, to North America. Not to say that they did, because it's entirely possible that the North American cultures, Native American cultures, independently ended up worshiping the snake. So I'm not here to say that they couldn't have, but it's interesting that we have serpent worship on both sides of the Atlantic going back to right around the same time period.
Yeah. I mean, the mounds are very, very anomalous. Some of them obviously had, were burials, may have had a two-part function, may have been a ceremonial site and also a burial site. We don't see those in places other than really the eastern part of our continent. And it's interesting to note that, you know, are these designed by these giant people? Are the mounds associated with the giants? I mean, how would you say there's a connection? Is there a connection, I guess?
I think it's an indirect connection. I think the Edina culture is a Native American culture that may have been influenced somewhat by, you know, Europeans and European giants who may have come over here. And we do find some of these burial mounds contain giant skeletons. But I think what that is sort of the end of the story. The beginning of the story is these giants came over here to help mine the copper. And then when they stayed, And they married into these tribes, the Edina culture tribes, the Hopewell tribes, that then some of their cultural attributes, whether it was serpent worship or other burial mound type things, other funeral practices, we see that influencing the American tribes after a few generations have gone by. So I don't think we're seeing a causal effect. I think we're almost seeing the result after they had sort of gone native, but some of their cultural practices were diffused into the North American native tribes.
That's interesting. Hey, let's talk a little bit about physiology, the remains of the giants we know about. Since we don't have a skeleton that I know about, some, you know, maybe there's some people listening that might know people that have them in private collections, but there's this talk about these double rows of teeth and very, very heavy bone mass in some of the reporting. What can you tell us about this double rows of teeth and why the need for that?
So the double row of teeth is interesting because, and this is something that Jim Vieira documents really, really well in his research, that many of these giants that are found in the burial mounds, the report seems to be, you know, it's almost like one person wrote the same report, which obviously, you know, pre-internet is not likely to happen. But they all seem to have these double rows of teeth. It's called hyperodontia. And the question is, how could so many reports spanning the continent at a time before mass communication all contain this strange detail. It, you know, some of the reports talk about an extra digit. Well, that makes more sense because that's in the Bible, and so you could see where some people might throw that into their story. But the idea of this double row of teeth, this hyperodontia, it's one of those sort of unique and telling details that scream out to me authenticity, because we see it over and over and over again. And how would a newspaper reporter, or not even a newspaper reporter, how would a farmer who finds a bone, a skeleton in Georgia, come up with the same detail as somebody who finds bones in Washington State and somebody who finds bones in Illinois? And we're talking thousands of miles apart, and yet they all come up with the same idea of this hyperodontia, this double row of teeth. It just seems such an obscure thing to have in common, unless there really was this unique attribute between these giants. And if so, that sort of lends to the credibility of the reports.
Yeah. Do we have any evidence of people today with anything like that might be evidence of a bloodline being carried through to present day?
So hyperodontia is a known medical condition in which there is a double row of teeth. I don't know if it's associated with extra height. In my book, of course, I have some fun with it. It is fiction. I do have a little bit of leeway to do stuff like that. And of course, I have a really tall character. And of course, he has hyperodontia. So, you know, that's no reason for a spoiler alert there. Everyone's probably saw that coming. You mentioned the physiology. We sort of touched on it a couple times. Remember, there's Robert Pershing, I believe his name was. I believe he lived in the Chicago area. He was 8 foot 11 inches. This was back in the early 1900s. And it was apparently still growing. And so the human condition does allow mankind to grow to be up to probably about 12 feet. There's something called the square cube law. And that's what limits our growth. But if we double someone's height, then the weight increases by 8 times, okay? It's sort of the square cube law, as I said, square cube law. And so at some point, we just become too heavy for our bones to support us, which is why, you know, elephants have those 4 really thick legs because their mass is so large. But that does allow humankind to grow to be in the 11 to 12-foot range, that square cube law. So And periodically we do see these pituitary gland disorders where we have these really tall people. Interesting, in the burial mounds when we find these giants, oftentimes we find clusters of them, and that indicates it's probably not a medical condition as much it is as a genetic, you know, either a unique gene that makes a unique race or a unique tribe or something. So it's probably not a medical condition that caused these giants we're talking about. It probably is a genetic mutation of some kind. And you know, we have... When people, I still get people sort of roll their eyes with this whole idea of giants. We have pygmies, you know, the Flores men in Indonesia. We have these people who are 3.5 feet tall, so they're a good 60% shorter than quote unquote normal humans. So why can't we have a race of humans that are 60% taller than normal humans, and that would get you up to, you know, 10.5 feet or so. So it works one way with pygmies; it should work the other way with giants.
Earth Angels is brought to you by Gaia, and Gaia is the top streaming media company in the world with original content on ancient civilizations, UFO, alien interactions, tons of personal growth material from everything from meditation to wellness in the form of nutrition, some of the new therapies for getting a stronger body, and so on. And they have a special program, and I talk about it all the time. For 99 cents, you can check out over 8,000 titles, and it's continuing to grow, too. They don't just stop at 8,000. 8,000 original titles from anything you can think of. They got a great series on pyramids. They got alternative science. And, Gaia is the top alternative website in the world. They have so much killer content. You got to check it out. Hey, and here's the deal. 99 cents to get started. You get a full month. You can check out everything. Hey, if you don't like it, jump off of it. But 99 cents to get going. And all you got to do is go to Gaia.com earthancients, and you can check out the entire thing. Hey, go check it out, will you? They sponsor us, and I think you're really going to like their material. I'm always on their website. I'm there like every other day just to see what's going on. So Gaia.com, it's GAIA.com/earthancients, 99 cents. You can't go wrong. You know, it's funny, speaking about present-day Native Americans, I did a special on Native prophecy. This is about, I'd say, 12 years ago in San Francisco, and I invited chiefs from or spokespeople from five or six different prominent Native people in the North America, including a Mayan elder who I eventually would befriend me. There was a couple of guys, and I'm trying to think of what tribe they were from, but they were about 6'4", 6'5", and I remember thinking, this is before the whole giant thing even came up. These guys were huge. I mean, 6'4", 6'5", natives. And I would later learn that there are certain Northwestern tribes that are very tall. And so
I'm sorry, I let you finish your thought. Sorry.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just these could be descendants from intermixing with giants.
Let's think about that for a second.
Yeah.
Because you said they're from the Northwest, and one of the other, and this gets off topic a little bit, but the idea that all the Native Americans came across the Bering Land Strait from Asia, okay. If so, we'd expect to find the Northwestern tribes to be even shorter because the Asian physiology is shorter than the European physiology. We all know that. So how do we end up with these really tall Native Americans if they all came from Asia? Well, again, we go back to the Cherokees who scream at us, no, 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 we didn't come from Asia. Our ancestors came across, they call it the Sunrise Sea, across the Atlantic, and DNA testing confirms they have some really interesting European DNA in them, and Dr. Stanford from the Smithsonian Institute, you know, once in a while they actually do good work, and he's got this whole Solutrean theory, in which in his mind many of the Native Americans did come across the Atlantic. They didn't all come across the Bering Land Strait, and so these pieces all fit together, and part of that story that those pieces tell is that we somehow need to get some really tall genes into North America if we're going to have these really tall tribes, whether they're giants or just natives who are 6'4 and taller. But somehow we need to get some tall genes into the pool. And where did they come from? Well, you know, you got to go to places that had tall people at the time. And, you know, Asia just is not one of those places.
Yeah. I remember the group was Lakota, and those guys were very tall. Apache, Sioux Indians were tall. Cheyenne, average. Maya, about average. But the one speaker was the grandson of Black Hawk. Boy, it was very interesting to know. And I'm thinking about that right now, which is kind of interesting.
We need to be a little bit careful because obviously many generations have gone by and there's very few pure-blooded Native Americans anymore. So who knows what's going on. But that's why some of these, you know, these 1800 burial mounds are so important, is because, you know, presumably as we're pioneering across the continent, this is sort of first contact. And this is before there would have been, you know, intermixing of different peoples. And so that's important evidence, and it's sort of hard to get past that. I mean, someone's going to have to come up with an explanation as to why there's, as you mentioned, 1,500 of these reports. You know, are they all wrong? Could they really all be wrong? Or is it more likely that at least some of them are right, and now we need to understand what was going on? It's frustrating that no one can sort of that historians will take perfectly good evidence and just sort of throw it away because it doesn't fit the narrative that they are trying to promote. It would be nice as a lawyer if I could go into court and say, you know what, Your Honor, I move that we throw away the fingerprint evidence against my client because it's not convenient. You know, that's not the way it works. If you're going to research history, you have to look at all the evidence, not just the evidence that's supportive of your case. It's common sense, and yet We see it all the time. The historians and the archaeologists sort of throw things away. They call them outliers, and they just say, we're not going to look at that anymore. It doesn't fit the paradigm that we're trying to promote.
And more of this paradigm protection happens in the United States than any place else. I was in Germany a couple of years ago, and they had an amazing collection of human anomalous bones, and there were no giants, but they had a history of the world, how man has evolved, the different types of cranial shapes and things like that. We have some a little bit of that here, but no, I mean, if someone found a 7-8 foot human being, I'd love for it to be preserved and be able to see it, because you're right. 1500 stories is not a small amount. I could say, you know, the chances of it being a hoax would be high if it was 3 or 4, but I mean,
right.
Vieira documents, you know, tons and tons and tons of these stories. And of course, they seem to really...
Many of them by the Smithsonian themselves. So it's not like these are all, you know, hillbillies or whatever. These are sometimes actually the Smithsonian archaeologist goes out and writes about it in the Bureau of Ethnology, and there it is. There's the report right there. So
yeah. I want to ask you something in your book. You do have a number of examples of writing. You have the Back Crete stone, and you have a number of rune stones that are left there to us. Is there any reference in any of these stones to giants or being with the giants of the area?
There's a stone in North Carolina called the Judicula Rock. And again, this is in Cherokee territory. And carved on that stone, it's believed to be some kind of astronomical map showing the stars and whatnot. But the Cherokee believe it was carved by ancient giants who came across the Atlantic. And it's a fascinating carving. It doesn't actually reference giants themselves, but again, the Native American legend is it that a race of giants carved it. So I'm not aware of any of the stones that actually mention giants. Now, part of the issue when he's talking about stone carvings is that unless they were carved on really hard stone, most of them fade away after 300, 400, 500, 600 years. And so if we're going back 2,500, 2,700 years, there's not going to be much left as far as stone carvings that we can use as evidence. Just that our weather just doesn't allow that stuff to preserve in an outdoor environment, freezing and thawing and winding and raining and all. You know, it just wears away even the hardest stone.
Yeah. Hey, let's talk about some more structures. And you reference the Newport Tower, which is located in Rhode Island. Now, that's not necessarily a giant facility, but it does have a lot of anomalous features in it, doesn't it?
Right, so now we're getting to an area, and you mentioned how the Europeans are so much more open-minded about their history, and this is example one of this whole. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Great, but in my mind, he was late to the party. But most of us have trouble just getting past the idea that someone was here other than the Native Americans before Columbus, and it's incredibly frustrating because the Europeans sort of look at you like, well, you know, the Vikings were there 500 years before Columbus, and doesn't it make sense that somewhere in that time period, other Europeans or Scandinavians would have followed the Viking maps or charts or legends and just continued back and forth? Because there were some really good reasons to come to North America, whether it would be fishing or trading pelts, or most importantly for the Scandinavians, timber to build their ships. If you go to Scandinavia today, there's no trees anymore, basically. I mean, that's what they needed to build these massive Viking ships. They needed our timber. So there's plenty of reasons to have come back and forth. And I think one of the examples of these journeys prior to Columbus is the Newport Tower. The architecture, it screams medieval. It's Romanesque architecture, 8 pillars, 8 arches, a round stone tower. If you were to see this in the British Isles, you would have no doubt that it was built sometime in, say, the 1300s or 1200s or somewhere in that range. And there's a lot of evidence that dates the tower to that time period, and yet mainstream historians in New England insist it was built in the 1670s as a colonial windmill by Governor Benedict Arnold, the great-grandfather of the trader Benedict Arnold, even though at that time Rhode Island and all of New England was in the height of the Native American uprising, and there's no way they would have built anything out of stone other than a fort. Why, you know, why waste your time building a windmill out of stone when you've got wooden structures you could use at the same time you're trying to defend your crops and your families? It's just a luxury you wouldn't bother doing. So there's so much evidence indicating this tower predates Columbus, and it's such a fascinating site. It's, again, it's not related to the giants, but it sort of kicks down the door of these historical paradigms that people put up for us and say, you know, no one was here besides the Native Americans prior to Columbus. Well, no. Europeans were here, Scandinavians were here, Mediterranean sailors like the Phoenicians were here. They may have brought giants with them. There's a whole, not just one chapter, three, four, five chapters of people, the Irish, Brendan the Navigator, many, many chapters of people coming to America prior to Columbus.
Yeah, and that's
I'll get
still
off my
hard.
Now. For, sorry, thank you.
What was the last part? I missed you. Go ahead. What was the last part?
I'll get off my soapbox now. Sorry
oh,
about
yeah.
that. I get a little passionate about that stuff.
Well, I mean, there's the American East Coast area is filled with anomalous structures, American Stonehenge, these weird mounds, these. The Serpent Mound, which is, you know, shaped like a big serpent. I mean, these are strange phenomenons that have no history. We have to just guess at it, you know. And it's there's so much in our face that is that predates Columbus, and yet we have a lot of problems around trying to change history. So, in the few minutes we have left here, what is the foundation you would say for giants in America? I mean, we have the stories, but why is it important to acknowledge giants?
Yeah, I don't think in and of itself there's anything particularly important about giants per se, but the whole idea about our history. I mean, I think that there's so much going on now with the quote-unquote fake news, and it's almost like the everything's gray. Like, if you can make the argument about something, then there's no real truth anymore. And to me, that's really bothersome. As a father of two young, not so young, they're college-age daughters now, but when I started, they were young. There's a whole, I treasure the truth in the sense I want my kids to know their history. I want my kids to know what this country's true history is. And of course, there's all these cliches. You can only, you know, you only can learn from history if you understand it to begin with and whatnot. But there's just this idea that we all want to know what really happened. And it's the kind of thing that keeps me up at night. I joke with my family that if I die before I figure all these things out, I'm going to come back and haunt you in your dreams and your sleep until you figure it out for me so you can tell me. But, you know, the idea of passing on before these mysteries are solved really bothers me. I just think there's so much that we don't know and so much has been kept from us. And I think sometimes just truth for truth's sake is really important.
Yeah, fantastic. My guest has been David S. Brody, and his book is The Oath of Nimrod, Giants, MK Ultra, and the Smithsonian Cover-Up. David, how can people learn more about you? You have a website and reference material?
I do, Cliff. Thank you. It's davidbrodybooks.com. And as you mentioned earlier, there's a series of these stories, and they're all based on ancient history, hidden history of America, you know, including the giants and the Newport Tower. I do try to write them as historical fiction so that there's a bit of a roller coaster ride to go along with them, because that's the kind of history I like to read. I like to be entertained while I'm learning. But davidbrodybrooks.com is, you can there's links that get you to Amazon and whatnot for all the books. If you like this kind of stuff, you know, give one of them a try. I think that's the kind of audience that I'm writing to, the kind of audience that we're speaking to today. And I appreciate the opportunity to do so.
All right. Hey, David, thanks again.
Cliff, my pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
Okay, so that was the program. Didn't edit enough there. A little left over. American Giants. That was interesting. A look at that. You know, it's interesting to think Phoenicians bringing over a giant race. We just don't know enough about the giants of Europe, the Middle East. And for him to speculate that these giants came from Lebanon – present-day Lebanon, it's just quite interesting to consider because there's a lot of very odd buildings and artifacts that lead us to think about giants in there. So that was fun. As a reminder, again, if you're interested in this mummy, you can see the first two episodes of a documentary. You got to go to Gaia, GAIA.com/Earth Ancients and check it out for a month. It's 99 cents. You can also go and see the first series on Earth Ancients Facebook. Go to Facebook, Earth Ancients. Go to group, the group page. Don't go international. Go to group. And I have the very first announcement of the discovery of this unusual mummy. So you can check it out there. We're going to have Melissa back on a regular basis to talk about programming on Gaia. Gaia is just amazing, the amount of content they have on their website. It's fantastic. I mean, think about anything having to do with Earth Ancients, Atlantis, pyramids, just hundreds of different subjects that we cover here. You can find detailed analysis and programming on Gaia, gaia.com/Earth Ancients. Okay, that's it for today's show. Hey, have a great weekend. And remember, it's summertime, so get out. Get out and do something. Okay, take it easy.